But anyway, the no sign saying no dogs or Chinese allowed exists, or that's what I've always said. But if you go on YouTube, you can now see that there is, in fact, photographic evidence of that sign, no dogs and Chinese allowed. But it's from a Bruce Lee movie, which is set in old Shanghai, and Jing Wuman, and you can see the whole clip on YouTube, and it's quite extraordinary. And I tried to screen capture the pivotal moment in it when he does this karate kick or kung fu kick that busts the sign into pieces. And when this was shown in Hong Kong in the 1970s, apparently the crowd went wild, because they were projecting, this was set in Shanghai in early 1900s, but they saw it through the lens of their experience of being discriminated against by the British in Hong Kong. So the closest I could get is the bottom there, where it's actually, he moves so quickly that the sign is being shattered. And above, there's an image of him being kept out of the park by a policeman. And I'll come back to it later. This is just another shot of the park where you see another important thing about Shanghai. The international settlement was very much like a displaced piece of Britain. This looks very much like a British park, complete with a gazebo where there was a municipal band. In fact, the dancer Margot Fonteyn, when she was young, she was taken to America, spent some time in New York, and then they went to Shanghai. And when she was riding up the river, she said, "Oh, look, Shanghai looks more like London than America ever did." All right, this is a notion which is also in guidebooks, that the stalwart buildings of the Bund are unchanging relics, a wondrous museum of international architectural styles. And thank goodness they weren't torn down, and thank goodness, I mean, I hope we can preserve them, because these are the buildings that were always there after, you know, from the kind of Opium War on. Or at least that's, it's not always filled in that way. And I am really glad they exist. They're a wonderful thing to look at. But this idea that this, the postcard shot of Shanghai that stands for the treaty port era, the fact that this kind of stands for the 1840s to the 1930s is problematic, because this was actually basically the third iteration of the Bund, of the waterfront area of the international. So it's very important to remember, even while we care about heritage and preservation, that as has been written about quite wonderfully with New York, the creative destruction of New York, these cities tend to be always undergoing a process of destruction and reconstruction. This is what the Bund first looked like once the Westerners had arrived in their first period of massive building, the first time when Shanghai was thought of as a place that suddenly had lofty buildings and which would impress people as the most modern city front. So this was the Bund 1.0. This was 2.0. which again gives you a sense of the sort of displaced part of Britain. You even have a clock that looks suspiciously like Big Ben. Then you have the third version, and that clock then migrates into this clock, which looks a little bit less like Big Ben, but got a nickname called Big Ching to have people remember. And the clock face and the chimes were sent over from London, specially made, or from England anyway. And they're quite dramatic. And then after the Chinese took control of this area, instead of tearing them down, quite amazingly, they decided, in part because they were so big, I think, they decided they'd appropriate them and put them to new uses. So there were banks. The big bank with the dome there was turned into a government headquarters. The chimes of the clock, Big Ben, that used to play a Western melody, were reprogrammed to play "The East is Red," Mao's personal theme song. This is inside the domed building, which is right next to the clock tower. This is one that shows all of the locations around the world that the Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank, one of the great banks, each place they represent two buildings or something that represents the skyline. And this is London. And this, in a great act of hubris, is Shanghai, in which representing the city is the building in which you're standing, where this mural went up right when it was completed. And next to it is the old clock tower, because the new one hadn't quite been built. Most of these photos I took, this one at great peril, because you're not allowed to take photographs there. So you have to kind of play dumb each time and just quickly take one. I still haven't got the full panorama. All right, moving beyond the notion that Shanghai once was and now is again a place where East meets West. This is one of the most common things you'll hear about Shanghai. Shanghai is a place where East meets West. And it used to be in the 30s, and now it is again. This is one of the most common cliches, and it never was quite sufficient, and it clearly is not now. Why not? It's not because things weren't coming together. This is an example of, again, that wax museum where you have this Lyceum Theater, you have these Chinese youths in Western suit and tie, probably drinking coffee, possibly tea, but possibly coffee. And this is East meets West. But in this wax museum, just over to the side, you can see the same table with an Indian drinking tea with them as well. This was the time, evoking the 1920s and 30s, when John Dewey and Bertrand Russell came through Shanghai to give lectures, but it was also when Tagore came through and drew big crowds. So Shanghai was, in this period, not just an East meets West place, but an East meets East place. And here's a photograph from the 1940s showing a different kind of East meets West, but the East being met in Shanghai by the Americans is Indian. And if you remember the shot of the scene of being kept out of the park, while the park might have been like a displaced piece of London in China, the guard would sometimes be Sikh employee of the British-run police force, and the anxiety or anger that Bruce Lee felt was because he was being taunted by Japanese who were able to walk into the park, whereas he couldn't. So there was the cosmopolitanism represented by, say, Tagore coming to lecture in this positive way. There was an East meets East side of the positive cosmopolitanism as well as an East meets West. And there was a kind of East meets East sign of colonialism and anger as well related to that period. And this is a shot of the most brutal form of East meets East connection in that earlier period, which was the Japanese bombing of the city in the 1930s. So, but still, I think for that earlier period, you can say, okay, largely it was East meets West in terms of products, in terms of buildings, and so forth. Okay, there was some East meets East, but it was largely East meets West. And you can think that the later thing is, again, the West can loom very large in this. And here's just a sort of collage of Starbucks comes to China, which I can go on at great length. And the Google map in the bottom is a shot of all the Starbucks locations, and there are dozens and dozens of them now. So this may seem a great symbol of America representing the West that's coming to Shanghai. But if you look at this photograph, which shows a Starbucks, that I've shown this Starbucks before, but I've started taking photos, and I won't show you them all, of many of the places you see a Starbucks, you also see an Ajisen, a ramen chain that's going up all over. You find sushi bars and many kinds of East meets East cosmopolitanism in Shanghai now. And in fact, the Starbucks, it's not just that it shares space with ramen stores, it's sort of symbols of Shanghai becoming cosmopolitan again. But the Starbucks is an American firm, but the management team that brought it to Shanghai was a Taiwanese firm, Presidential Coffee, that had previously brought 7-Eleven stores to the Philippines. So it was thought of as being able to understand how to bring this American chain in. And the main high-level coffee shop that it competed with was a Japanese firm that had come in a couple of years before and had been sort of reintroducing coffee culture to this city. If you walk around Shanghai's streets, you see a lot of tall buildings that bring to mind sometimes Manhattan, or initially brought to mind Manhattan, except now it has many, many more skyscrapers. So it doesn't really bring to mind Manhattan. If you go to Manhattan, you say, okay, where are all the rest? But you also are struck by these large video display screens around the city, which are much more reminiscent of an Asian style of urbanization, certainly of Tokyo. So the urban form and the buildings, when you look at them more closely, the tallest building in Shanghai was underwritten by a Japanese firm. Many of the department stores in Shanghai are underwritten and developed by Hong Kong developers. Taiwan, there are now Westerners living in Shanghai again, but there are hundreds of thousands of Taiwanese, by some estimates 500,000, living there. Even though China and Taiwan don't have political relations, their economic and cultural relations are tied in. I often think that with many kinds of globalization, but including the reglobalization of Shanghai, we should think not only of Big Macs, but of karaoke bars, if we want to think about how global culture is circulating. here's a spot where I looked out of, this is one of the nicest new restaurants in Shanghai, and I looked out there and I saw this. I thought maybe I was overdoing the East Meets East. I look out there, saw this boat being built there, and I thought, what is that? And they said, you know, because of the movie. I said, what do you mean? Titanic, which is was enormously popular in China. And I don't know how they were trading on Titanic in this exactly, but I saw that. I thought, okay, Western movies are very big here. I looked at the advertisement as people playing basketball, and it's advertising zippers. Okay, this is all East meets West. But the building that I was in, the restaurant, is called Din Tai Fung, which serves Shanghainese food, but it's a Taiwanese firm that has a franchise. Arcadia has a great branch of it, if you ever feel like driving up for some authentic Shanghainese food made in Taiwan. And not only that is it coming back, but on the walls of it, showing a connection to global popular culture, you can look at one way and you see the basketball players in zippers. You can look at the other wall from there and inside it, and you see these are Hong Kong celebrities. And Jackie Chan has a foot in Shanghai. He has a store there. Shanghai Tang, a fashion firm that started in Hong Kong, now has a branch in Shanghai. So there are all these weird ways in which global culture coming back to Shanghai is coming partly through these other places. Final point. Walking through Shanghai today, the juxtapositions of remnants of the old city and the new city are striking. All right, this is another thing. You say the kick about going to Shanghai is you've got, you know, the Treaty Port buildings right next to the really big buildings. My even opening saying you're going to hear about the Treaty Port period and you're going to hear about the 1990s and the present. Yeah, it's true. One of the kicks about Shanghai is the juxtaposition of eras, but it's the juxtaposition of more eras than just the present and that earlier period of cosmopolitanism. For example, when you walk around the city, you can see the fastest train on Earth, the maglev train, which I took the photo at the top, which was how many kilometers per hour it was going when I was riding it. The picture below it is from the web. But you also see some reminders of an earlier period, but a later period. You see Shanghai still as a bicycle-driven culture down below, though it's now becoming increasingly car-driven. You still see scenes like this that you don't see in an American street of tons of cars. And then you see the juxtaposition of a treaty port building and a new skyscraper. But one of the kicks of Shanghai actually is that there's also this pre-Opium War city as represented by Yew Gardens at the bottom there. So you have these multiple periods. You have the pre-treaty port period. The treaty port period is called Old Shanghai, so I don't know what to call older than Old Shanghai, so Shanghai, which is represented by some of these sites. Then you have the treaty port period, which again has multiple angles, but still the treaty port period. Then you have some remnants of the Mao period, and then you have the post-Mao period. And then I would argue with the train in particular and some of the other images, you have Shanghai as a place to see the future or a possible future. So you're actually these multiple juxtapositions of temporalities. And these show up in the art, they're increasingly showing up in the art. These are just some shots I took of the last biennale, which had all sorts of things. One of them says past and present Shanghai. Another, it's hard to read, but with the girl on it, talks about postmodern Shanghai. Their image is the future, and the train is a throwback, a reminder of the often overlooked, but in this artistic form reminded, 1970s. And there's Mao coming back in. These are just some other images of the juxtaposition of eras. And in the magazines on the ground there, which you can't really see in this, it's sold side by side as reminders of the past. Cultural Revolution era posters, though these are partly marketed to foreigners, and advertisements from the 1930s. Kind of all, there's a kind of promiscuity of jumbling together parts of different pasts. The juxtaposition of eras is now even starting to affect movies. Shanghai is still being used as a site for old films set in the 1930s, period pieces, dramas that make the use of the old buildings that stand, but Code 46 represents a new trend, which is to film in Shanghai futuristic sci-fi movies. Michael Winterbottom, the British director, wanted to shoot a film set in the future, but he didn't want to spend all the money making special sets. And he also thought the future would look more like the present than it usually does in sci-fi films. So he said, where on earth can I go and shoot where the audience will be fooled into thinking this place can't possibly exist? And he shot in Pudong, Shanghai, then also in Dubai, rolled them together into a Shanghai of the future. The final bit of past and present coming together is back to the expo, which you'll be hearing more about as 2010 comes closer and the Olympics recede. It itself is a weird mixture of past, present, and future. It's China's first World's Fair, so it's something about the present. It's linked to the Olympics. It's its second part of a 1-2 punch of saying we're here as an important modern country in the world. But it seems kind of oddly old-fashioned to us who had our World's Fairs in the late 1800s, early 1900s. And it's being celebrated in Shanghai via books that on the cover show things like the Eiffel Tower and the Ferris wheel and saying now it's our turn to do that kind of thing. And the point of it is to be the most wired World's Fair ever, the most technologically. World's Fairs were always places you went to get a glimpse of the world as it is, the cosmopolitan of the world, and a glimpse of the future. So you have this kind of old-fashioned seeming event being advertised being this future by this futuristic kind of giant television LCD screens all over the city. And so you have this odd juxtaposition of the past, the present, and the future. And if you want to read more about that, there's a book you can buy, which is by a historian but ends in 2010. Thanks for your attention. I look forward to questions. If there are any questions about things I've said you want to hear more about, things I didn't say, things you wish I hadn't said?
What about the dam that they built? Is that the Yangtze area?
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of things to say about the Three Gorges Dam. I think one of the things to say about it is that if we think about China now, for better and worse, doing things that we did at a period when we were becoming the world's leading economic power. You know, one thing we had was World's Fairs that proclaimed our cities have arrived as states of modernity. And another thing we did was these massive public work projects, including giant dams, that we would now say, you know, the Hoover Dam, you know, it should not have been built. We shouldn't have done that. And the most complicated thing, I think the single most morally complicated thing as a China specialist is to figure out how to engage in this dialogue without seeming incredibly patronizing, without seeming like we had our turn to do these things that help propel us to where we are. And I would not live in Georgia without air conditioning. But this dam that you're building that's like the dams that we used to build in parts that people can have air conditioning in places with climates like Georgia, you shouldn't do because now we know better. And I think it's an argument that needs to be made but is incredibly complicated to make, to both say, you know, here's an opportunity, we have these global problems we need to solve together and this isn't the way to go, but to not say glibly, don't you realize you're ruining these beautiful locales? And the one time I went down the Yangtze or was visited with, I was with a tour group, I was lecturing to alumni from my last university, going through and I was striking up conversation with the boat, with the people, you know, who were punting the boat along. And I said, so what do you feel about this? You know, we've heard a lot about it and the discontent of people being forcibly relocated and things. And he said, you know, this is our one chance to get out of here. And, you know, my parents, my grandparents, they never left this village here. And I'm getting a new, I mean, but of course they think it's horrible, you know, because this has all sorts of emotional ties. So it's this very, I think it's enormously important to realize, and that's just a caricature of it, the enormous generational divides within a country that's gone through in some ways what ordinarily should be a century of transformations or would be in a period of a decade. Yeah. Yeah. You want to hear more about it. Well, I had to have a crash course in it when I showed an early draft of my manuscript to the woman who's written most beautifully in English about this topic, which is Lin Pan, and her book Shanghai Style. If you buy one book about Shanghai, I won't modify that. Buy hers. It has beautiful color illustrations. She writes in an admirable way that is informed completely by scholarly research, but is utterly accessible. I try to come close to that. She's a model as well, a role model as well as a friend. First of all, that in terms of the architecture, it's much more neoclassical than Art Deco. So if I would have talked more in kind of the architecture of the Bund, I would have said, you know, there are pillars, there are other things that evoke the neoclassical period. Inside, you see some of the decoration from Art Deco. Art Deco did have an impact, but it doesn't show up as much in this. But it was it's a great example of the East meets West. It's also of a complication in that once a couple of the most striking buildings in Shanghai that are associated with kind of state-of-the-art 1930s architecture were designed by a Hungarian architect, Hudak, and I'm not sure where you place Hungary on the east or west. So it's a kind of, the West could come via a place that Westerners at that time would have thought of as the East. So it's a great topic. Get Shanghai Style. It's wonderful about this. And so, yeah. Thanks. complicated one. I've been thinking about this lately because I occasionally see things about the great cities of the world right now are largely rocketing forward toward globalization under the guidance of a particularly energetic or insightful mayor. There was a piece in the LA Times by the architecture critic talking about the super cities. And he mentioned London, Shanghai, New York, you know, and you've got to pay attention to what the mayors are doing. Now, the problem with this is that yes, it matters a lot who the mayor of London is when they're deciding whether to bid for the Olympics. The Shanghai mayor can want to put in a bid for the Olympics, and the central government can say no. You know, this is a national thing. The mayor is much more subordinate to the national authorities. So there is a mayor, but it's kind of a misnomer. There's a city head. It's not like our mayor, not just because he's not elected, but also because he shares power with the party secretary, who's kind of a co-mayor. So there are two people, one officially representing the government, another representing the party that essentially runs the government. So there's a power sharing thing there. They both have to, in a sense, answer upward to the central authorities. What really matters in China is if a former mayor of your city becomes powerful in the national government, often then your city gets a kind of go-ahead. And so a big deal, Shanghai took off in the 1990s, partly because a former, I think he was at one point both a mayor and at a different point a party secretary, I'm not sure, Jiang Zemin, became then a national authority and yet had ties to Shanghai. So you kind of want somebody with ties to and fondness for your city to get up higher. And mayors are sometimes sort of training ground, or party secretaries, training ground for seeing if you're going to get higher. Oh, there are districts that have different heads. So there is a breakdown there, but it's not like, again, it's not like city councils because it's not, you know, that's not elected. Or it's elected, but there's only one candidate, which, you know, is kind of a limitation. To the extent, though, one of the most interesting things that's happened recently, I wrote about this a year ago, there were some of the first middle-class protests in Shanghai by people who were actually asking for they wanted input on the urban planning proposals that would affect their neighborhood, an extension of the super fast maglev train. And so they took to the streets to say, we should have been consulted before this because it's gonna, they were claiming it would be dangerous to their health and the health of their children, which we're not so sure about, but it would definitely be very noisy and their property values would go down. So Chinese have just begun, again, to be able to have property values to care about, which leads to a kind of middle class concern with more of a say in what goes on. And initially, at least, they've been successful to avoid alienating partly this group that's largely happy with the way the direction of the country is going as a whole. but wanted more control over this part of their life. I mean, this is a longer lecture, but my sense of where China's been going in the last 20 years since Tiananmen is, at least in the cities, it's a very different thing in Tibet and Xinjiang, and it's a very different thing in parts of the countryside, but in the cities, the government has wanted in part to make it less likely that something like Tiananmen would happen again. The protesters at Tiananmen wanted many things. They wanted more choices in their private life, they wanted less state interference in their daily life, and they wanted more say in who ran the country and how those people acted. The government said, well, we're not going to give you the choice of who runs the country, but we actually can give you more of these other choices. We'll give you more choices about what books you buy, how you entertain yourself. And these are important things, you know, private life. We'll get out of your face somewhat in, you know, daily life. You can be apolitical. You don't have to, you know, show up and say rah, rah. You just can't protest. So in part, you know, that was what I think of as the new social contract in China was, you know, you let us keep ruling and we'll give you, we'll give you a lot more of these small freedoms. So now what's interesting is you get these some cases where people are saying, well, yeah, but because of how we're attached to the small freedom of choosing where we live, now we're not happy about not having control about what works project goes through. So a lot of the discontent now is about the state doing things that people are realizing the only way they could have an impact on it would be a state that listens to them more. Well, it's interesting how, I mean, I'd want to know more about your friend's mother. I mean, no, there was actually something very enjoyable about life. I mean, we could tell the story a little differently. We could say, you know, you can still rely upon shopping daily for fresh food and cooking it up that day, and this is what the custom is, and actually I don't want a refrigerator because that's not how I want to live, right? So, I mean, it's not as though you could be in the greater Shanghai area and not have electricity. Outside of it. I think that the biggest divide, one of the biggest divides within China becomes when you go into the sort of hinterland countryside area, which is very far from Shanghai, which is inland. How far would be very far? A few hundred. Yeah. No. It would be to the places of really extreme poverty are not in the Yangtze Valley area, which is, you know, around the nearest cities to Shanghai itself. So you would be talking about places more than several hundred miles away. So you would have, but that doesn't mean that there are just, once you get, the city of Shanghai keeps sprawling. But there are kind of satellite villages not that far from it in which people are living less recognizably modern lives when we think about it. But compared to other developing countries, one of the odd things in China is how few of the sort of dramatic slum-like breaks between sort of what people talk about as first world and third world within a mile. You don't really see much of that in China. Occasionally, in some places you can see it, but not to the extent that, I mean, unfortunately it's what's stuck in our minds from Slumdog Millionaire, but there is an air to it from the little bit of reading I've done about Mumbai, where you just have that idea of a kind of self-contained world that's in almost a different temporality or time zone within the city. And in Shanghai, you really don't. You get a kind of hyper-modern core, and then a partially modern periphery, and then you gradually get out to those things. But the real break is between that whole eastern seaboard that's been booming with the economic reforms and other places that have just been radically, radically left behind and don't have access to this kind of thing in a kind of simplistic way. that's all. And feel free to come up to me privately.
Oh, Jeff, thanks very much. That was very exciting and interesting. It's a library tradition to thank our speakers by placing a book plate in a book in our collections that commemorates their presentation. And we've chosen for to commemorate your talk a book known to you, Global Shanghai, 1850 to 2010, yours. And here is a facsimile of the book plate that will be going in that volume for you. So thanks very much. Our exhibits require a tremendous amount of work, and I want to acknowledge the talented staff in our library design services. Julia Corsera and Sage Kim prepared and installed the exhibits and designed the publications along with Sylvia Irving. If you enjoy tonight's programs and you're not a member of the Partners of the Libraries, please consider joining. Our library's partners support the library's collections and services as well as all of our public programs for the community. So there's brochures in the table outside. I also want to mention two other library events that are coming up soon and in the fall. On May 29th, the libraries are offering a workshop titled Preservation 101, Basic Tips for the Household Archivist, led by Michelle Light, archivist and interim head of special collections. If you're interested, you can sign up at the registration table in the lobby. And in the fall, our fall exhibit will be on Darwin, and it'll open on October 22nd, and it'll feature a talk by Donald Bren, Professor of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology, Francisco Ayala, I always stumble over that, on Darwin's gifts to science and religion. So thank you for coming, and enjoy the reception. Jeff, sure.
If you can't get enough of China, and since I ended with a very brief nod to India, on Friday from 2 to 3:30 on this campus in HIB 110, a Humanities Instructional Building, there'll be a public event, a roundtable on intellectuals and the nation in China and India, in which we're fortunate enough to have a distinguished writer in residence, Pankaj Mishra, will be one of the people speaking. Wang Chao-hua, who was a leader of the Tiananmen protests in 1989 and is now an independent scholar. Perry Link, University of California, Riverside, noted translator of Chinese literature and scholar of Chinese literature, and our own Vinayak Chaturvedi of the History Department. So if you're interested in getting another dose of China and an East meets East kind of discussion, please come to that. Thanks.
Thank you for coming. Please enjoy the reception and the exhibit.